Well, he had advanced the man the down payment and had accepted a first and second mortgage on the place. Obviously, the union president hadn't contributed a damn thing. Junior thought it was all right because he had done it out of personal money, not company funds. There was hell to pay, of course. The National Labor Relations Board got involved. There was talk of sending both Junior and the union man to jail. We lost one newspaper because of it, the one in Baltimore. There was no question Walter could leave under such circumstances. And, of course, a thing like that takes years to settle down. Fletcher's inner ear heard Lydia say, "He's every bit the man his father was, of course, even better in many ways." "We're all entitled to one mistake," Lydia said. "Junior's was a beaut. You see, Fletch, it was really the fault of the board of directors for doubting Junior so. He felt he had to prove something. You do understand that, don't you, Fletch? You see, I think Junior needs a special kind of help." Again, Lydia was sitting back on the divan, staring at the floor, clearly a very troubled person. "Mrs. March, I think you and I should talk again in a day or two." "Yes, of course." With dignity, she stood up and put out her hand. "Of course, it is now when Junior most needs the help."
"Yes," Fletch said.
"And in reference to what you said," Lydia continued to hold his hand, "Junior and I did speak about you tonight at dinner. He agrees with me. He would like to see you involved in March newspapers. I wish you'd talk with him more about it when you can."
"Okay."
At the door, she said, "Thanks for coming up, Fletch. I'm sure you didn't mind missing Oscar Perlman's after-dinner speech. Think of the people down there in the dining room laughing at that dreadful man."
Chapter 26. 10 p.m. Women in Journalism. Face it, fellas, few stories take 9 months to finish. Group discussion, Aunt Sally Hendricks' sewing room. From tape. Station 4, Suite 9, Eleanor Earls. Eleanor Earls was saying,
"Thought I'd go to bed.
I brought champagne."
"That's nice of you, Raleigh, but really it is late."
"Since when is 10 o'clock late?" asked Raleigh Wisham. "You're showing your age, Eleanor."
"You know I just got back from Pakistan Sunday."
"No, I didn't know."
"I did."
"How are things in Pakistan?"
"Just dreadful."
"Things are always dreadful in Pakistan."
"Raleigh, what do you want?"
"What do you think I want when a man comes calling at 10 o'clock at night bearing a bottle of champagne?"
"A very young man."
"Eleanor, darling, this is Raleigh Wisham with love."
"Very funny, you phony."
"Eleanor, you're forgetting Vienna."
"I'm not forgetting Vienna, Raleigh. That was very nice."
"It was raining."
"Rain somehow turns me on."
"Shall I run the shower?"
"Honestly, Raleigh, look, I'm tired and I'm upset about Walter.
Big, great Walter March. Sprung you for bail once in Albania. And what have you been doing for him ever since?"
"Knock it off, twerp."
"How come everyone in the world is a twerp, except one old bastard named Walter March?"
"Okay, Raleigh, I know you've got all kinds of resentments against Walter because of what happened to your dad's newspaper and all."
"Not resentment, Eleanor. He killed my father. Can you understand? Killed him. He didn't make the rest of my mother's life any string symphony either. Or mine. The word resentment is an insult, Eleanor."
"It all happened a long time ago in Oklahoma."
"Colorado."
"And you only know your side of the story."
"I have the facts, Eleanor."
"If you have facts, Raleigh, why don't you ever go to the court with them? Why haven't you ever printed the facts?"
"I was a kid, Eleanor."
"You've had plenty of time."
"I'll print the facts one day. You'd better believe it."
"Shall I open the champagne?"
"No."
"Oh, come on, Eleanor. The old bastard's dead."
"Did you kill him, Raleigh?"
"Did I murder Walter March?"
"That's the question. If you want to be intimate with me, you can answer an intimate question."
"The question you asked was, did I murder Walter March?"
"That's the question. What's the answer?"
"The answer is, maybe."
There was the pop of the champagne bottle cork and the immediate sound of its being poured.
"Really, Raleigh?
Here's to your continued health, Eleanor, your success, and your love life."
"You don't take a hint very easily."
"Not bad champagne for domestic."
"What is it you really want, Raleigh? We can't duplicate Vienna in the rain in Hendricks, Virginia, with an air conditioner blasting."
"Let's talk about Albania." That's even worse. I don't like to talk about Albania. But you do. You talk about Albania quite a lot.
Well, it made me famous, that incident. You know that. The network took damn good care of me after that. And damn well they should have, the twerps.
I've never believed your story about Albania, Eleanor. Sorry, journalistic skepticism. I'm a good journalist. In fact, I just got a good review from a People. More champagne? Suddenly you're being strangely unresponsive.
I haven't anything to say.
You mean you haven't anything you've ever said?
You came here to find out something, right, Raleigh? You came here for a story. Raleigh Wisham with love and a bottle of champagne. Well, there is no story, Raleigh.
Yes, there is, Eleanor. I wish you'd stop denying it. You've told the story so often, attributing what Walter March did for you to Walter March's goodness. You've blinded everybody to the simple, glaring fact that Walter March wasn't any good. He was a prick.
Even a prick can do one or two good things, Raleigh.
Eleanor, I think you've just admitted something. I suspect I picked a fortunate metaphor.
Get out of here, Raleigh.
Walter March had to have some reason for springing you out of Albania. He sent his own man in, his Rome bureau chief. You know what it must have cost him. Yet he never took credit for it. He didn't even scoop the story. He let our old network take the credit. Come on, Eleanor.
Raleigh, I'm going to say this once. If you don't get out of here, I'm going to call the police.
The Hendricks, Virginia police?
House security.
Come on, Eleanor. Tell old Raleigh.
Jesus, I wish Walter had lived. He would have nailed you to the wall.
Yes, Raleigh Wisham said. He would have.
But he can't now. Can he, Eleanor?
There are a lot of things he can't do now.
Aren't there, Eleanor?
A phone was ringing. Lying on his bed, half asleep, Fletch wasn't sure whether the phone was ringing in Eleanor Earle's room or his own. Shall I leave the champagne?
You know what to do with it.
Good night, Eleanor. It was Fletch's own phone ringing. Chapter 27.
Ye old listening post, Fletch said.
He had sat up on the edge of his bed and thrown the switch on the marvelous machine before answering the phone.
Hell, I've been trying to get you all night.
You succeeded. Are you calling from Boston? How many hours, days, weeks, months of his life in total had Fletch had to listen to this man's voice on the phone?
I've never known a switchboard to be so damned screwed up, Jack Saunders said. It's easier to get through to the White House during a national emergency.
There's a convention going on here, and the poor women on the switchboard have to work from only one room information sheet. Are you at the Star?
Jack had been Fletch's city editor for more than a year at a newspaper in Chicago. More recently, they had met in Boston, where Jack was working as night city editor for the Star.
Fletch had even done Jack the minor favor of working a desk for him one night in Boston during an arsonist's binge.
Of course I'm at the Star. Would I be home with my god-awful wife if I could help it?
Ah, Fletch said, the continuing romance of Jack and Daphne Saunders. How is the old dear?
Fatter, meaner, and uglier than ever.
Don't knock fat.
How can you?
Got her eyelashes stuck in the freezer's door lately?
No, but she plumped into a door the other night. Got the doorknob stuck in her belly button. Had to have it surgically removed.
Fletch thought Jack remained married to Daphne simply to make up rotten stories about her.
I saw in the Washington newspaper you're at the convention. Working for anyone?
Just the CIA.
Yeah, I bet. If you're at a convention, you must be looking for a job. What's the matter, blow all that money you ripped off?
No, but I'm about to.
I figure you can give me some background on the Walter March murder.
You mean the Star doesn't have people here at the convention?
Two of them, but if they weren't perfectly useless, we wouldn't have sent them.
Ah, members of the great 16.7%.
What?
Something a friend said.
So, how about it?
How about what?
Briefing me.
Why?
How about old times' sake as a reason?
So I can win another award and you not even tell me, but go accept it yourself and make a nice humble little speech lauding teamwork?
Such had actually happened.
Saunders said,
I guess technically that would come under the heading of old times' sake in this instance.
If I scoop the story, will you offer me a job?
I'll offer you a job anyway.
That's not what I asked. If you get a scoop on this, will you make with a job?
Sure.
Okay. You want background or gossip at this point?
Both.
Walter March was murdered.
No fooling.
Scissors in the back.
Next you're going to say he fell down dead.
You're always rushing ahead, Jack.
Sorry.
Take one point at a time. Walter March was murdered. I've written it down.
He was murdered here at the convention where everybody knows him and a great many people hate him.
He is the elected president.
You know that Walter March kept a stable of private detectives on his permanent payroll?
Of course I do.
His use of them has irritated many people, apparently given many people reason to murder him. In fact, if you believe what you hear around here, dear old saintly Walter March was blackmailing everybody this side of Tibet.
Do you know whom he was blackmailing and why?
A few. He's been having Oscar Perlman followed and hounded for years and years now.
Oscar Perlman, the humorist?
Used to work for March. His column got picked up by a syndicate and has been running in March's competing newspapers ever since.
That was 1,000 years ago.
Nevertheless, he's been hounding Perlman ever since.
So why should Perlman stab March at this point when he hasn't before?
I don't know. Maybe March's goons finally came up with something.
Oscar Perlman, Jack Saunders mused. That would be an amusing trial. It would make great copy.
Lydia March says she saw Perlman in the corridor outside their suite immediately after the murder, walking away.
Good. Let's stick Perlman. Anything for a laugh.
None of this is printable, Jack.
I know that. I'm the editor, remember? Daphne and all those ugly kids of mine to feed.
Raleigh Wisham hated Walter March with a passion. He has reason, I guess, but I think his hatred borders on the uncontrollable.
Raleigh Wisham with love?
The same. He says he was so upset at seeing March in the elevator Sunday night he didn't sleep at all.
What's his beef?
Wisham says that March, again using his PIs, took the family newspaper away from Raleigh's dad and drove him to suicide.
True?
How do I know? If it is true, it happened at a dangerous age for Raleigh, 15 or 16, I forget which. Loves and hatreds run deep in people that age.
I remember. Did Wisham have the opportunity? You said he was there Sunday night.
Yeah, and he has no working alibi for Monday morning. He says he was driving around Virginia in sunglasses in a rented car. Didn't even stop at a gas station.
Funny. This is Raleigh Wisham with love, and the scissors in Walter March's bag.
You know March was planning a coast-to-coast campaign to get Wisham thrown off the air?
Oh, yeah, I read that editorial. It was right. Wisham's a fucking idiot. The world's greatest practitioner of the suffering Jesus school of journalism.
Keep your conservative sentiments to yourself, Saunders. You've been off the street too long.
Two good suspects. We'll start doing background on them both right away. Anyone else?
Remember Crystal Fioni?
Crystal? Petite Crystal? The sweetheart of every ice cream store? She used to work with us in Chicago.
She tells me that once when she was pregnant without benefit of ceremony, March fired her on moral grounds. Crystal had no choice but to abort.
That bastard, that prude. Walter March was the most self-righteous.
Yes and no, Fletch said.
Well, I'll tell you, Fletch, Crystal has the intelligence and imagination to do murder and get away with it.
I know. I'd hate to have her as an enemy.
Me too. I shiver at the thought. I'd rather have a boa constrictor in bed with me.
This Captain Andrew Neal, who's running this investigation, what do you think of him?
Well, he's no Inspector Francis Xavier Flynn. Sometimes I think Inspector Francis Xavier Flynn isn't either.
Flynn was the only person working for the Boston Police Department with the rank of inspector.
I think Neal's all right, Fletch said. He's working under enormous pressure here. The press is all over the place, trying to interview professional interviewers.
He's under time pressure. He can keep us here only another 24 hours or so.
Is there anyone else, Fletch, with motive and opportunity?
Probably dozens. Robert McConnell is here.
McConnell? Oh, yeah. He was what's-his-face's press aide. Wanted to go with him to the White House.
Yeah, and Daddy March endorsed the other candidate coast to coast, which may have made the difference, gave Bob his job back and sat him in a corner where he remains to this day.
Bob could do it.
Murder?
Very sullen kind of guy, anyway. Big sense of injustice. Always too quick to shove back, even when nobody shoved him.
I noticed.
We'll do some BG on him, too. Who's this guy Stuart Poynton mentions in tomorrow's column?
Poynton mentions someone? The desk clerk?
I've got the wire copy here. He mentioned someone named Joseph Molinaro.
Never heard of him. I wonder what his name really is.
I'll read it to you. In the investigation of the Walter March murder, local police will issue a national advisory Thursday that they wish to question Joseph Molinaro, 28, a Caucasian. It is not known that Molinaro was at the scene of the crime at the time the crime was committed. Andrew Neal, in charge of the investigation, would give no reason for the advisory.
Mean anything to you, Fletch?
Yeah, it means point and con some poor slob into doing some legwork for him.
Fletch, sitting back here in the ivory tower of the Boston Star, if that's an ivory tower, I'm a lollipop. I can lick you any time.
Ho, ho.
My vast brain keeps turning to Junior.
As the murderer?
Walter March, Jr.
I doubt it.
Living under Daddy's thumb all his life?
I've talked with him.
That was a very heavy thumb.
I don't think Junior's that eager to step into the batter's box, if you get me. Mostly he seems scared.
Scared he might get caught?
He's drinking heavily.
He's been a self-indulgent drinker for years now.
I doubt he could organize himself enough.
How much organization does it take to put a scissors in your daddy's back?
Fletch remembered the stabbing motion Junior made sitting next to him in the bar and the insane look in his eyes as he did it.
Fletch said, maybe. Now, would you like to know who the murderer is?
Jack Saunders chuckled.
No thanks.
No?
That night during the Charlestown fires, you had it figured out the arsonist was a young gas station attendant who worked in a garage at the corner of Breed and Acorn Streets and got off work at 6 o'clock.
It was a good guess, well worked out.
Only the arsonist was a 43-year-old baker deputized by Christ.
We all goof up once in a while.
I think I can stand the suspense on this one a little longer.
Anyway, Christ hadn't told me.
If you get a story, you'll call me.
Sure, Jack, sure. Anything for old time's sake.
Chapter 28. From tape, Station 5, Suite 3. Donald Gibbs and Robert Englehart.
Snow, beautiful snow.
From his voice, Fletch guessed Don had had plenty of something.
Who'd ever expect snow in Virginia this time of year?
Fletch couldn't make out what Englehart muttered.
Who'd ever think my dear old department heady, Bobby Englehart, would travel through the South with snow in his attaché case? Good thing it didn't melt.
Another unintelligible mutter from Englehart.
Well, I've got a surprise for you, too, dear old department heady, Gibbs said. What's that, you ask with one voice. Well, I've got a surprise for you. Remember those two sweet little things in Billy Bobby's boo-boo bar lounge? Sweet little things, you say together. Well, sir, I had the perspicacity to invite them up to our glorious journalist's suite this very night, this very hour, this very minute. In fact, for 20 minutes ago.
You did?
I did. Where the hell are they? Gotta live like journalists, right? Wild, wicked women. Live it up.
I invited someone, too. Englehart's voice sounded surprisingly cautious.
You did? We're going to have 4 broads, 4 naked, writhing girls all in the same room?
The lifeguard, Englehart said.
The lifeguard? Which lifeguard? The boy lifeguard? There weren't any other type. I looked.
Englehart muttered something. There was a silence from Gibbs. Then Englehart said, What's the matter, Don? Don't you like a change?
Jesus, 2 girls and a boy, and us for a fuck party. An orgy. Bob!
Take it calm, Gibbs.
Where's the bourbon? I want the bourbon. Back of my nose feels funny.
The doorbell in the suite was ringing.
And the Lord High Mayor ate pomegranates, Don Gibbs said. Surprising fellas, department heads. Lifeguards with snow on. Boy lifeguards.
Confront new situations, Englehart said. Part of your training. Field training.
Never saw anything about it in the manual.
Englehart said, You can do it that way, too. Fletch's own phone was ringing. Hello? He had turned the volume down on his machine. It was Freddie Arbuthnot.
Fletcher, I thought I'd be more subtle. Meet you for a swim, or have you about had it for today?
Are you in your room?
Yes.
Can't you hear my tape recorder?
That's how I knew you were still awake.
Then you should be able to figure out I'm working very hard on my travel piece.
By now, I think you'd have said everything there is to say about Italy.
You can never say enough about Italy, a gorgeous country filled with gorgeous people.
All work and no play.
Makes Jack.
Why don't you stop working and come for a swim? We can have the pool all to ourselves.
What time is it in your room?
Midnight, 12:35. What time is it in yours?
My dear young lady, Crystal Fione got very cold in that pool during the mid-afternoon.
And with all her insulation,
she was chilled.
I saw your efforts to warm her up.
Now, if she got cold in mid-afternoon, what do you think might happen to us at 12:30?
We might get warmed up.
You missed the point, Ms. Arbuthnot.
The point is, Mr. Fletcher, you shot your wad.
The point is, Ms. Arbuthnot,
she said, and I thought you were healthy,
and hung up. There was a poker party, or the poker party, going on in Oscar Perlman's suite, a wacky tobacco party in Sheldon Levy's, silence in the Litwax. Leona Hatch was issuing her rrrrs regularly. Jake Williams was on the phone to a March newspaper in Seattle, sounding very tired. Something about how to handle a story about a fistfight among Major League Baseball players in a downtown cocktail lounge. In her room, Mary McBain appeared to be all alone, crying. Charlie Stieg was in the last stages of a seduction scene with a slightly drunk unknown. Raleigh Wisham and Norm Reed were tuned to the same late-night movie in their rooms. Tom Lockhart's room was silent. Fletch switched back to Station 5, Suite 3.
Switch!
Don Gibbs was shouting.
Everybody switch! Swish, 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 I said.
There was a considerable variety of background noises, some of which Fletch had difficulty identifying. A girl's voice sang, Snow, beautiful snow.
Everybody get your snow before it melts,
Don Gibbs said. It was the sound of a hard slap. Engelhart's voice, low and serious, said,
When I pay money, I want to get what I pay for.
Cut that out, Gibbs said. I said switch, everybody switch.
A young man's voice said, You're not paying for that, bastard.
Switch, I said.
Fletch listened long enough to make sure a second female voice was recorded by his marvelous machine. Then Don Gibbs was saying,
Wee, we're living like journalists, goddamn journalists. Goddamn that, Fletch, live like this all the time, disgusting.
Fletch put his marvelous machine on automatic for Station 5, Suite 3, and took a shower. Chapter 29. Wednesday. The sun was up enough to have dissipated the dew, and, after a long but gentle gallop, make Fletch hot enough to stop and pull off his t-shirt and wrap it around his saddle horn. When he stopped to do so, his eye caught the sun's reflection off a windshield between trees up the side of a hill. So he rode to a point well behind the vehicle and then up through scrub pine level to it, where he found an old timber road. He rode back along it. Coming around a curve in the road, he stopped. A camper was parked in the road. Behind it, lying on his back, blood coming from his mouth, was the man he had been looking for, the man the masseuse, Mrs. Leary, had mentioned, the man in the blue jeans jacket, the man with the tight, curly gray hair. He was obviously unconscious. Over him, on one knee, going through a wallet, now looking up at Fletch apprehensively, was none other than Frank Gillis. Fletch said, Good morning.
Who are you? Gillis asked.
Name of Fletcher.
Gillis returned to his investigation of the wallet.
You work here?
No.
What then, staying at the hotel, Hendricks?
Yes.
You a journalist?
There was a touch of incredulity in Gillis's voice.
Off and on.
Fletch wiped some sweat off his stomach.
You're Frank Gillis.
You got it first guess.
For years, Frank Gillis had been traveling America, finding and reporting those old, usually obscure stories of American history, character, odd incidents, individuals, which spoke of and to the hearts of the American people. During days when America had reason to doubt itself, both abroad and at home, Gillis's features were a tonic which made Americans feel better about themselves, even if only for a few minutes, and probably, during the nation's most trying days, did a lot in their small way to hold the nation together. Fletch said, And you just mugged somebody.
Gillis stood up and dropped the wallet on the man's chest.
Yeah, but guess who, he said. Get down. Come here, look at him.
Gillis was a man in his 50s, with gentle, smiling eyes and a double chin.
Fletch got off his horse and, holding the reins, walked to where Gillis was standing. He looked down at the man on the ground. His was a much younger face than Fletch had expected, much, much younger than indicated by the gray hair.
My God, Fletch said.
Right.
Walter March.
Gillis was looking around at the tops of the trees, fists on his hips, still visibly provoked.
Why'd you mug him?
I have a distinct dislike of people flicking lit cigarettes into my face. He ran his hand over his cheek, left of his nose. I only hit him once.
You know him?
Don't care to. I stopped to ask for directions.
The great explorer of contemporary America smiled sheepishly.
I was lost. This guy was standing here behind the camper rolling a cigarette. When I saw his face, I was astounded. I said, "My God, you're the spitting image of..." And a real rotten look, real pugnacious, came into his face. So I stopped, and he lit his cigarette, and he said, "Of who?" And I said, "Old March, Walter March." And flick, the cigarette went into my face, and I'd hit him before I knew it. He looked down at the much younger, inert man. "I only hit him once."
"You hit good," Fletch said. "Glad I don't smoke."
"No way to get a story," Gillis said, rubbing his knuckles. On the ground, the man's head and then his left leg moved.
"What's his name?" Fletch asked.
"Driver's license says Molinaro, Joseph Molinaro, Florida license." The camper had Florida license plates.
"Golly," said Fletch, "this guy's only 28 years old.
Gillis looked at him sharply and then said, "Young body, you're probably right." Suddenly, Molinaro's eyes opened, immediately looking alert and wary, even before shifting to focus on Fletch and Gillis.
"Good morning," Fletch said. "Seems you took a nap before breakfast."
Molinaro sat up on his elbows and then reacted to the pain in his head. His wallet slipped off his chest onto the dry dirt of the road.
"Take it easy," Fletch said. "You've already missed post time."
Molinaro's eyes glazed, and he looked as if he were about to sink to the ground again. Fletch put his hand behind Molinaro's arm. "Come on, you'll feel better if you get up. Get the blood going again." He helped Molinaro stand, waited while he wiped the blood off his lips, examined it on his hand. Molinaro looked sourly at Gillis. Throwing off Fletch's hand, Molinaro staggered the few steps to the back of the camper and sat on the sill of the open door.
"You have some bad habits," Gillis said, "and I have a quick temper."
"Your name Joseph Molinaro?" Fletch asked. The man's eyes moved slowly from Gillis to Fletch without losing any of their bitterness. He said nothing.
"What relation are you to Walter March?" Gillis asked.
Still the man said nothing.
"Are you his son?" Fletch asked.
The man's eyes lowered to the road and then off into the scrub pine. And he snorted. Fists again on his hips, Gillis looked expressionlessly at Fletch. A mosquito was in the air near Fletch's face. He caught it in his hand. Gillis went to the side of the road and gathered up his horse's reins and slowly returned to where he had been standing. He said to Molinaro, "You are Walter March's son. With that face, you have to be. Did you murder him?"